Chapter 24. Leaving Auschwitz. In January of 1945, the bombings increased and we heard artillery fire coming ever closer. Every day different rumors were heard about the camp. Unrest and tension grew. We said to ourselves, don't run any risks or attract attention. Just try to hang on. Maybe we'll make it after all, even though it seems impossible. That is what we thought, but no one really believed it was possible. Many of the German masters were missing in the plant where we worked. They were supposedly drafted. Discipline, as well as production, declined. In the plant, one saw uniformed men who were members of the anti-aircraft division. The civilian non-Jewish workers with whom we could speak encouraged us. The Russian front drew closer. Tension filled the air. The normally strict German order became chaotic. The camp files were packed or burned. Selections were reduced. Lack of interest spread everywhere, among the military as well as the civilian masters of the plant. The camp was supposed to be evacuated. All sick people who were ambulatory were discharged from the medical building. Seriously ill patients were shot. Some people talked about evacuation by train, others about liquidation. Things developed differently, however. The war situation did not allow for a systematic evacuation, since there were no longer any means of transportation available. Marching on foot was the only possibility. It also was probably too late for our liquidation. On the morning of January 16th, 1945, after a short roll call, we started marching westward in rows of five. We noticed that the so far well-planned and well-executed program of the SS no longer could be carried out according to their will. 10,000 famished prisoners with ragged and scanty clothing were turned over to the icy cold. We marched towards the west. Our SS guards accompanied us in cars, on motorcycles, bicycles, and horse-drawn wagons, continually shooting all those who were too weak to continue and who thus delayed the march. They were pulled out of the rows and shot on the side of the road or in a ditch. Their numbers were not small. Those who had sweaters or blankets were of course better prepared to withstand the cold. Those wearing wooden shoes suffered the most. Marching in them, kilometer after kilometer, became the worst torture. There were many prisoners who limped, fell down, or slipped on the icy roads. It was a dreadful and desolate sight. Thousands marching, emaciated, heads shaved, and oppressed prisoners in tattered striped suits, slowly moving westward. After a march of about 40 kilometers, we reached Nikolaev, where we spent the night in a brick factory. We had only a roof over our heads. We therefore lay close together in order to warm each other with our bodies. In our exhaustion, we were happy just to lay our heads down somewhere. The only thing we had to eat was the double food ration which was consumed before leaving camp. We hardly saw any civilians on the road. It was probably closed to all traffic because of us. Along the way, we noticed other groups of marching prisoners from Auschwitz and its auxiliary camps. The sound of artillery became fainter. The next day, we walked another 30 kilometers and reached Gleiwitz. All week, limping and complaining prisoners were shot continually. Discipline had to be maintained. It was an infinitely strenuous march in the cold, snow and ice. For many, it became a death march. For the rest, it was torture. Gleiwitz was a border station between Germany and Poland, and the gathering point for prisoners of all the concentration camps, including the men and women from Auschwitz and its satellite camps. Although we had not seen any transports of women, we were told they were also approaching there. In Gleiwitz, the confusion was great upon our arrival. Among the thousands of prisoners, one saw many SS men, but no civilians. At one place, bread was available. At another, one could get blankets and shoes. And at still another, soup and tea. We saw SS men who were carrying provisions, two big loaves of bread, two cans filled with either lard or meat. Some prisoners jumped on this food. A few officials fought them off. Others put up with it. No punishment followed, and no one was shot, as was the usual custom. We were in a big camp outside of town, which was minimally fenced in. Earlier, foreign civil workers had been lodged in the wretched barracks. The camp was not big enough to accommodate all the prisoners, so everyone who found a place to lie down was happy. From minute to minute, our fate became more insecure. Gleiwitz, in such confusion, could never be our goal. Perhaps the SS no longer had control of the situation. The most likely possibility was that we would be shipped to another concentration camp. There were, however, no trains to be seen. Everyone speculated about a forthcoming liquidation by poisoning or shooting. Naturally, we thought about Majdanek, where 18,000 Jewish prisoners were shot in one day. Repeatedly we heard the artillery. Some of us desperately hunted for a hiding place, but that was hardly realizable. In the chaos, one could not form a group or meet with friends to discuss plans. Like all the others, I was searching for a hideout, which I finally found in the attic above the bathroom of an old barrack. When I climbed up, I met two friends from the camp who had provided themselves with bread and wanted to stay there until the Russians marched in. Unless, of course, they were discovered first. Who knew what was right? These two comrades, Prichitsky and his cousin, persuaded me not to stay with them. Even though they would not admit it, the main reason they rejected me was that I had no food reserves, and because my hunger would surely be a burden to them. That was the first time that my camp know-how had been proved wrong. In the camp, I lived by the routine of eating everything as soon as I got it. I would stuff myself with food, instead of saving the small portions, and even fighting an even bigger battle with myself. At least I can say that no one ever stole my bread. Here in Gliwice, with the Przyjaciółki, this practice became a liability for the first time. The Przyjaciółki and two other prisoners survived. 2 days later, they were liberated by the Russians. I met them by chance after the war, and of course forgave them for their seemingly selfish behavior. Rather than become a burden, I left the hiding place. I reflected on the situation. In this chaos, I could go to the city, but with my clothes, shaven head, physical condition, and appearance, I'd be recognized immediately as a prisoner, and consequently would either be arrested or shot. Only someone with friends in that town or region, on whose support he could depend, had a chance to flee. I continued to look for a hiding place, but without success. After 2 days in Gliwice, the SS machinery was revived. The trains arrived, and again we were treated more severely. The slackened reins were tightened once more. Prisoners in groups from their former camps were collected and loaded into the trains. After 19 months in Auschwitz, I left Gliwice, travelling towards uncertainty. I had the impression that even for our rulers, the journey was heading for the unknown. On January 21st or 22nd, 1945, on a bitter cold day, we were packed like sardines under unimaginable conditions into open train cars, 150 to 200 people in one car. There was no possibility of sitting, let alone lying down. Our only protection against the rain, snow, and cold were tattered blankets which we held over our heads. The only heat was body heat. Before the start of our journey, we received some food. Gliwice, a camp used for food storage, was soon to fall into the hands of the Russians. Our train was guarded by SS men, who sat outside the cars in little guardhouses. We headed west. After the first few days, hunger tortured us, but we suffered mostly from thirst. From continuous standing and immobility, our legs became numb and swollen, our blood stopped circulating. Basic human needs caused problems, but in the open cars, they could be relieved with relative ease. In this situation, friction and aggression became more prevalent. Powerlessness, apathy, melancholy, and hysteria became rampant. Some cursed, some shouted, others scratched their neighbors' faces. Many died standing. Sometimes hours passed before we realized that the quiet person standing next to us was dead. The bodies were laid on the floor and the living stood on top of them. Thus we could soon move our arms more freely because we had more room. Occasionally the train stopped for several hours, but usually on the outsides of towns and villages, so that we saw little or nothing of the civilian population and vice versa. From our zigzag course we could tell that we were traveling without direction. Our situation was indescribable. Half-dead people from concentration camps fought for their lives with their last bit of strength and breath. Packed in cars with dead bodies at our sides and underfoot, we were exposed to hunger, thirst, and cold. I cannot remember that I received anything to eat on that trip. Perhaps I got some water or soup. I really cannot recall. We simply could not think straight anymore. I know for certain, however, that SS officials guarded the train at every stop. Only a few prisoners jumped off or disappeared when we stopped, and they usually did so only to end their lives. Most felt paralyzed and could not find the strength to jump. A decisive factor for survival was the place in which the prisoners stood in the car. In the center, one had the advantage of heat, but next to the car walls there was more elbow room. The latter places were especially coveted. Prisoners standing at the wall were the first to receive food. Since there was never enough of anything to go around, only those who had a little more luck or freedom of movement received something. People lost control. Everyone nearly went mad. All of us fought against the numbness and for a little water, bread, and indeed life. This horrible, seemingly endless journey took us first to Vienna, then to Czechoslovakia, Prague, and Pilsen, as far as I can remember. From there to Hamburg-Neuengamme, At the camps we reached, we were turned away because of overcrowding. For hours our train remained on side tracks. Then we continued to travel from south to north, and from north to west, and with neither direction or knowledge of our destination. Although we were told to cover ourselves with blankets while passing cities and villages, people often saw us, and our cries for bread and water could not be ignored. I can remember only one incident in Czechoslovakia, where slices of bread were thrown from a bridge into our cars. Otherwise we saw only silent, almost petrified faces staring at us. We must have been visible, since our train was very long and moved slowly, being driven by two locomotives, one in front and one in the rear. Because of the long duration of the trip, the incidence of people jumping off the train increased. These people had suffered enough. They wanted to be shot. To assuage our hunger and thirst, we ate the snow which covered the rusted iron car walls. We lapped the rusty liquid. This possibility was restricted only to those who were standing along the walls. Those in the centre of the car did not have the possibility. We stood there motionless, like wooden statues. Where would we find the power to survive? With the thoughts of jumping in my mind, I fell half asleep and saw my sister Sonia with another girl whom I liked very much. Both of them implored me, "Hold on, stay where you are. You still have to suffer a bit. It will take some time, but you will make it." I awakened and did not know whether my dream had lasted 3 minutes or 3 hours. I awoke out of depression, a man with new hope, and with a goal not to succumb, but to continue fighting. This dream was a source of hope and determination from which I drew strength until the final liberation. It helped me a great deal. I also reassured myself with the old motto which had helped me in Majdanek. It is not only a question of life, but each death of a Jew gives Hitler and the Nazis exactly what they want. I wanted to survive, at least for that reason, to spite our enemies, out of Dafka. I also did not want the Nazis to prescribe for me the manner in which I was to die. The journey continued, as did my struggle to survive. After many concentration camps had rejected us, and after 11 days of suffering, we finally landed in Nordhausen, Harz, at Camp Dora. Out of the 10,000 prisoners who were loaded in Gleiwitz, purportedly only 6,000 survived the journey. The enormity of this tragedy became clear only when the cars were unloaded. We then realized how many dead bodies were standing at our sides or lying under our feet. The dead were piled up and removed by a special work detail. We who were still alive felt half dead when we left the cars. Hardly anyone could walk. We could not feel our limbs. Every part of our bodies was wooden. Our legs refused to carry our bodies. We were so apathetic that we did not react to anything and allowed everything to be done to us. We did not care, but our tormentors did.